The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for joining me tonight for what I consider a very special edition of The Heretics Hour. It's January 20th, 2014, a date I've been working toward for about 2 months now, and I have two very interesting guests who actually know each other quite well and who are also known quite well by the general public, at least a pro-white public for sure, and I don't mean that in any specific way, but I know that that public is very interested in Holocaust revisionism. My guests are Guillermar Rudolph and Bradley Smith, and Bradley will be checking in soon. Guillermar Rudolph is already here. Hi, Guillermar.
Hello, hi, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, you know, I very much appreciate you coming on, and it's important that you are on today to talk about what's coming up here. And I want to remind people that you have a personal website. It is www.guillermarrudolph.com. And Bradley, when he comes on, I won't interrupt to say this, his best place to find Bradley's website is at codofounder.com. That's www.codofounder.com. But you find him elsewhere too. And of course, Guillermar has other sites, that might not be in his name now, but used to be, and that are, you know, have, well, there are a lot of sites, and if you want to, Guillermar, you can mention some of those.
Yeah. Well,
you don't have to. Okay. Don't sound like you want to. But.
Well, no, I had just to close the door here because there was just too much interference. Oh. The most interesting, the most important to me are the Holocaust Handbook websites.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say there are two of them, actually, holocausthandbook.books.com, and the same in German is holocausthandbücher.com, with a U-E, for those who can speak or understand a little German. Because that's the series I started back in 2000 for the English readership as an actual series. And the same exists in German in the meantime, too. As a matter of fact, I started publishing stuff in German, of course, but I didn't really do it as a series, even though it turned out, because when I started, I didn't know it going to be a whole series of books. In the meantime, we have 25 or 26, and there are more coming. And but organizationally, we have now arranged them the same way as the English language ones. And that's kind of the summary of my life's work, what I consider important to get a scholarly, a university-style series of research books on the Holocaust out there for everyone to see. And it has reached now a level that you cannot find among what we call the orthodoxy, the Holocaust orthodoxy. There are a lot of books, of course. I think there may be some 100,000 books out there about the Holocaust, and a tiny minority of them, even among the orthodoxy, are considered scholarly. Most of them are works of literature, fiction, and anything in between. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to actual scholarship, they're not 100,000. There may still be 10,000. But taking it as a serious, trying to address every issue very scholarly on the core issue of the Holocaust. I mean, Holocaust is a broad concept. It can encompass everything that has to do with anything that was done against a Jew or the Jews during Third Reich Germany, Germany's existence, not just by Germany. And that's, of course, an inflationary way of looking at the Holocaust, but that's how we come to 100,000 books, because everything is kind of thrown in there. But the Holocaust Handbook series is just focusing on the core issues of the claims of extermination, of physical extermination. And there is no series out there like this that has 25 and growing number of scholarly research books that focuses really on every aspect of this core issue I'm kind of proud that I started it and it is being continued. It has taken on a life of itself. It seems like people consider it important enough to continue it, even though I'm not at the helm anymore. So that is what I consider the best of it. Now, of course, we are going to have Bradley with us, and he has Coda.com under his leadership still. He's always had, ever since it was incepted in, I think it was 96. And that's where, for the English language readership, probably the most material can be found. And the most modern site too, even though it's not very lively right now, but that's because of our resources of the revisionist community in general that try to approach things scholarly are stretched very thin, and therefore there's not a lot of time to do blogs. But associated with Coda, there's Inconvenient History, which is trying to keep up a magazine, and it's doing a pretty good job, a magazine of addressing these issues that I used to do.
Yeah, I was just looking at Inconvenient History right before we started the show. I was familiar with what was on the new issue, the winter issue.
They have a blog too, which is more lively than what we.
Yes, yeah, the blog is not kept up with too well. I had quite a few articles of my own put on that blog back when I think because Thomas Cuse is not being able to take care of it right now is what I understand.
He has had some major health issue starting in the middle of last year, but he's slowly recovering, so he's probably coming back.
Oh, good. I'm so glad he's recovering. You know, when you hear those things, you don't know if somebody's on death's door or what, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we were completely in the dark ourselves for a long time because we haven't heard anything, but he is now given word that things are going to be all right, so we're all glad about it.
Oh, good. That's good.
Yeah. And then there's, of course,
Come with the Einstein group in then.
Yeah. Well, and then there's, of course, the Coda blog itself, the discussion.
Okay, here's the call. Go ahead and talk. Go ahead. It takes me a while to do this.
What are you typing? Working?
Yeah. Well, I answered. I'm answering Bradley's call here.
Oh, okay.
So, should work.
So, yeah.
There
my old website, at VHO.
Hey, wait a minute. Let's say hello to Bradley. Hi, Bradley.
Hi, Bradley.
Bradley.
Yeah,
come on,
I'm here.
No joking now. All right.
You're more to take care of me.
Yeah, I tried my best. Hi, Brad.
Okay.
Hello.
All right. Well, that's good. Well, Bradley, I already introduced you and gave your website, codofounder.com, and now Garamar, after talking about himself, he's busy telling us all about Codos and what we can find on Codos.com. So he's doing that for you.
Okay, that's good.
All right. We'll continue then, Garamar. Sorry for the interruption.
Yeah, I had veered off from that, the VHO.org website, which I had webmaster since its inception until I was arrested. It has gone kind of dormant. Keeps being a repository of all sorts of material, and as such, it's being kept up, but no new stuff's really posted there. So,
well, it's important to keep these sites up that are full of information, and people go to them and use them. So, did you have some more you wanted to cover before?
No, it's just, I mean, anyone who feels like wanting to volunteer to keep things lively, to post new stuff or assemble from the World Wide Web worthwhile material and put it on Coda, which we try to make the center of revisionist websites when it comes to the English language. Anyone who thinks he can contribute, chip in there, is welcome to contact Bradley and maybe help us out to keep it more up to date and alive than it is right now.
Okay, I think lots of times people get the idea, and I've had that idea, that that they're not wanted or they're not welcome, that there's a group there that's putting what they want, and so we want to disabuse people of this idea, right?
That is true. On the other hand, you know, we try to keep maintain
standards,
a certain standard.
Yeah,
and sometimes people are not being treated appropriately just because everybody is completely overworked and doesn't react timely, and then things go out of control there because, you know, if you say, okay, I'll volunteer for this, drop them an email, and you don't hear anything for a month or two, you may think, well, they don't need help. I mean, the truth is that some of us who have taken care of it just overloaded with other stuff and have not paid attention to it or filed it somewhere, forgot about it, and not very professional, I admit. But the whole thing isn't professional. That's the idea of it. We're all amateurs, and we're doing it on the side. It's not that there's anyone working on any of this full time, except for Bradley himself, who's doing his Smith Report and other things, but he's not doing the website itself.
I work full time. I work full time. I just work all the time, but I'm not always working on revisionist work, so I'm not a full time revisionist. But I do work full time. There are people, I know some people who work full time, but not, I guess, over there at CODO, is just Bradley. Well, all right, let's move on to, the latest thing that's going on, why we're gathered here tonight to talk about this, and that is this website commemorating the revisionists who introduced sanity to the Auschwitz death camp narrative, which has gone online since about 5:30 Central Time, Central U.S. Time this afternoon, and it is at www.january27.org. And that's spelled just JAN27.org. And it's, so this is another thing that has come along here, to add to, stir up, hopefully, some interest, in a different kind of a way than what we already have. And it's not trying to be, the same thing of, you know, what we have, although it's the same message, you know, but it's a little bit different. Anybody who wants to go there right now, any of the listeners who are listening, can easy, you know, just JAN27.org, and you'll see it, and you can look it over while you're listening. It's called that because it's being done in conjunction with the January 27th date for the other commemoration, which was inaugurated 9 years ago by the United Nations. It's held at the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial and Museum in Poland, this commemoration, and also at the United Nations in New York City. And guess what, guys? Maybe you already know, but I just learned today that the guest of honor and featured speaker at the United Nations, which will be next Monday, a week from today, will be Steven Spielberg. Big surprise, huh?
Bueno. Yeah.
Of course, that's highlighting what this is all about. It's about show, it's about fiction, it's about make-believe, it's about blowing things out of proportion and distorting them and making something out of nothing that can be sold for big bucks. So that's Steven Spielberg, and that's appropriate to use him, isn't it?
Yes. Well, just to get back for a second, what do you think about the idea, this idea of having this commemoration for revisionists, but really to get out, you know, our story once again on this day that they are commemorating their big story? And do you think that there's going to be any anger about that or any reaction, or do you think they'll just ignore it and pretend like it doesn't exist?
That's the first approach they always have.
Go ahead, Bradley. Bradley, you're going to have to speak up a little bit louder on your phone.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
That's better.
If they're smart, they're going to ignore it because nothing, as soon as they get involved with any kind of discussion like this, the story goes against them because there's so much fraud and falsehood in the story. that it's indefensible in detail, and the concept is indefensible. And so they're going to, all of these people on the other side are going to tell each other, don't say anything. And that's not the way it was in the 90s and the 80s. When I got started, I could do on a full-page ad in the Daily Crimson at Harvard, referring to Deborah Lipstadt as a fascist, and they would run it. But now, the last thing I did at Harvard was a text link, and it caused so much commotion, it went all over the Western world, that they will never accept another, even a text link from me with 7 or 8 words.
Yeah, so I've noticed that.
Yeah, the other side is running this very intelligently from their point of view, and they're in touch with everyone, and they've told everyone, don't respond. One, don't help them in any way whatever to publish or to speak, and don't help them by responding publicly to what they do. Just shut them down wherever you can. And as a matter of fact, on the front page of CODO, on the home page of CODO, there's a link to a manual published 3 years ago by Hillel, the Jewish organization on campus, and the Anti-Defamation League, that's devoted to telling people how to avoid allowing any advertisement by any revisionist into any campus newspaper in America. It's a 10,000-word manual, and of course they've gotten out to everybody, and it's very well done. It says, frankly, that it was aimed in response to this campaign at the campus. And it's very well done, and it's been very effective.
Okay. Well, you know, that's your thing that you came up with and you've been working on for years now, trying to reach the people on university campuses. It's a very good idea. It's a very good project. I mean, that's the place to go. But yet, it's very hard to even make a tiny dent in these students who you'd think would be more receptive to it, right?
Yeah, it is very hard. Of course, they have no without personal research to trust me, and they have every reason without any research to trust their professors. And the professors are committed to the Orthodox story. You know, it's what we call academic groupthink. They're all tied into the same story. As a matter of fact, I'm actually doing something I just started this month. I've actually begun a new campaign on campus, and I had a remarkable personal experience here a couple weeks ago. I was thumbing through one of the books I've published, Breaking Bones, Personal History of Moral Decay. And I hadn't looked, you know, you publish a book and you don't go back, you're not reading the book. And just by some, I don't remember why I was thumbing through the book, but I opened it at page 18. No, I didn't do that. I opened it at chapter 18. And I read the first line. And the first line read, thing like, I dreamed that I was gassed at Auschwitz.
I know why you were looking in that book.
Why?
Bradley. Which
yeah,
you seem to have
me.
Forgotten is that you're looking for something to send to me for this January 27th website.
That's right.
Yes. And
I forgot that.
You sent that.
My God, you're the responsible for everything I'm doing.
Well, I was wondering, I was just a little bit put out, but not too much. But, you know, just a little bit.
You know
you
what?
Sent that
I
to
remember
me
that.
I've got it on this website, and now you're promoting it all over the place yourself and asking people to read it and so on. So I thought, well, it'd be kind of,
oh,
that's
yeah.
Okay. It really doesn't matter because the more people read it, the better. And I don't know how many people are going to be reading this website for a while. It takes a while for people to get used to things because it's great. It's just fantastic. And I told you, I thought it was just
yeah,
great.
Yeah,
and,
that's
know,
right. You know what? That's been completely left out of my story. I couldn't, well, first I forgot about that I even wrote it, and then I forgot I forgot that you were asking me for stuff. That's right. I wonder why the hell was I thumbing through that old book? I never look at it. And mm-hmm. I was looking for something for Carolyn. Yeah. And but anyway, it was a kind of a remarkable experience for me because I had forgotten it. And in the dream, I saw the faces of the work Jews who were accused of helping the Germans murder and dispose of thousands and tens of thousands of other Jews. Mm-hmm. And the work Jews that are accused of committing these acts might include members of their own family. And I woke from the dream to understand for the first time that Jews did not do what they are charged with having done. I had this dream in 1979. And they simply, I'd lived and worked with Jews for 25 years, you know, and I saw all these faces there. And it just didn't occur to me. And it was really remarkable. But later, New Year's night, I was getting my jammies on, and the brain came up with another idea. And the idea is that the accusation that Jews would collaborate with Germans in the Auschwitz gas chambers to mass murder their own wives and children.
Yeah, or even just friends and neighbors or whatever.
Yes, and friends and neighbors. The story that the academic community supports they acquiesce in the story. They don't promote it, but they acquiesce in it. And this acquiescence is on the part of the American professor an act of anti-Semitism. It had mm-hmm. never occurred to me because the gas chamber stories are always used as an example of German inhumanity. And the part that the Jews played in helping to run the operation, and which they talk about, is simply not discussed. And the thing is that when the professor supports the story about the Germans and the Jews at Auschwitz, those who ran the show, they're supporting an anti-Semitic agenda, which they've been committed to for so long, they cannot reject the agenda, they can't admit to the agenda, and they can't discuss the agenda. But the American professor nationwide is supporting through acquiescence an anti-Semitic narrative.
Well, what you're saying is because these, and as you put it in your chapter there, these Jews, in order to, as they put it, you know, to gain a few more days of life, or because they stay alive, but they're all going to be put to death after a certain period of time because they know too much, right, according to this narrative. They go along and they do this and they work in these gas chambers. They say, well, they had to do it. Well, of course they weren't. They didn't have to. And they should. Any real people, even Jews, would say no. But these characters didn't say no. You know.
Well,
go ahead, Jeremiah.
Yeah, the story is a little bit more interesting. They kind of course, always claim there were a lot of SS men standing behind them with the rifles and telling them either you do it or we shoot you. And that's exactly not the case, according to the same witnesses who tell us that the stories, what they have done and what happened. The same Jewish witnesses have also told that they were, say, 60 Jews working in this crematorium where they were performing the extermination, and they had two SS men supervising them. Two.
Yeah.
And some of them, they weren't even armed. So, no, there was nobody standing next to them holding a rifle at their head. Nobody.
Well, they weren't even doing that work in the gas chambers because there wasn't any gas chambers. I mean, the whole story is just, that's why they, you know, the whole story is false from beginning to end.
But the thing that interests me is not merely that, a revisionist have argued for years that this story is false. But neither revisionists nor the academic community have ever made the, to my knowledge, it certainly isn't prevalent, has never made public the fact the academics are supporting a narrative
of anti-Semitism. Huh? They're supporting through their acquiescence in this a narrative that is anti-Semitic to the core.
Well, and, you know, I put that article. I started out put it under gas chamber. So I want to say a little more about the website now. You know, it's got a number of categories that are let me open this up here that I fit everything into. And one of those categories is gas chambers, of course, in quotes. And that's where I had it first. But then I had too many articles under gas chambers and only one under moral question. And then it occurred to me, Bradley, that that belonged under the moral question. So I moved it there. And I was real happy to have something for there because that's really what your story is about. It's not so much about the gas chambers. It's about the morality.
No, it isn't.
Yeah.
It's about the acquiescence of the American professoriate in the orthodox story, which is not only an expression of anti-German bigotry and hatred, but is a story that is never discussed, to my knowledge, of an academic acquiescence in an anti-Semitic theory.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the story that I'm going to be working with, and I'm doing it now.
I can tell. I can tell.
Yeah. I send this, for instance, I've sent a letter to the advertising. Oh, they refused to accept the link, of course, in the Daily Trojan at USC. And so I published a letter to the advertising manager making these points. And of course, he's not going to respond. It would be silly for him to respond because his position is indefensible. And so then, just today, I've sent a letter to the student editor of the Daily Trojan. Now, the thing is that at US, when we sent it to the advertising manager, we sent it, and this is to 5,000 email addresses on the USC campus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a matter of sending the letter to this guy, Tulicki is his name. But we've copied that to 5,000 email addresses, academy, academics, administration, and student orgs at that camp. Now we're starting the same thing with the letter to the editor.
Okay. We're going to have to move on here, Bradley, a little bit about, I want to point out that, Germar has written two brand new articles for this website, and one of them, let's see, is under gas chambers, and one is under, what's the other one? I have to look around.
Was just there. What did I look up? The other one.
Religion. Don't you dare. It's under religion. What the actual titles of these categories are, like Auschwitz as religion and Auschwitz. So if I go to Auschwitz as religion and we start out with, oh, yeah, this thing that we kind of collaborated on a little bit, but then I wrote it up about Holocaustianity becoming the new religion of Europe, and I itemized all these things. But it started out from Carlo Mattonio and Jürgen Graf in a book that they wrote, but it's been around too. People have often commented on this in this way. So we start out with that, and then we have Don't You Dare Doubt Auschwitz by Germar Rudolph. And that's a new article from you, and the other one is new too, has never appeared anywhere.
That's right. I should have written another one. There's something that irks me sometimes. Coming to commemorating the 27th of January every year. I'm a German, no secret about it, and you get the impression as a German sometimes when you think about it that German national holidays get desecrated on an international level, one after the other. The 9th of November used to be Hero Commemoration Day in Germany after the First World War, for people who have died in the World War, and then in the Third Reich, it was commemoration for the members of the movement who died during the revolution, right. Whatever they call. So now, of course, on the same day, basically the so-called Reichskristallnacht happened, the pogrom against the Jews in Germany in 1938, and that's now predominating. Then we had in 1989 the fall of the wall, which initialized the reunification of the Germany. So we have some positive events there, but they're completely muffled and stifled by commemoration of what happened to the Jews on that one day. And you have the same with the 27th of January, which is International Holocaust Memorial Day because of the alleged liberation of Auschwitz. So there's something that should be addressed thoroughly. Was it a liberation? No, it was not. The Red Army came in and mass raped the women that were in the camp and deported many of them to Siberia, and they didn't see liberty for another decade or two or never.
Where is the proof, or where do we find that? Because I don't have any success in finding anything like that. That when the Red Army came in, they actually raped the women in the camp.
And the Chicago Tribune had an article about that in 2004, if I'm not mistaken, one of my books, I quoted it, where they, based on, I don't know what, wrote an article of what happened when the Red Army came into that camp, what happened to the people there. Hmm. Makes you think why a lot of these people actually made witness statements according to what the Soviets wanted them to do, because otherwise you have a chance to either get raped, sent to Siberia, or testify what we want you to. and there has been a story not too long ago, several months ago. I didn't hold on to it because I'm not too deep into it anymore. Otherwise, had I been in publishing magazine, I would have grabbed it. There was a story of a lady, a Jew who was interned in Auschwitz, got quote-unquote liberated by the Soviets, got deported to Siberia, and then fell in love there with some Russian, married him, and only now managed to emigrate or something like that at a high age of 80 or whatever. And she was telling her story, and that was not an exception. She was stating it there. That's what's happened. When you were left behind, you had a chance to go with the SS to West Germany or stay there and be liberated by the Soviets. So if you get liberated, you get sent to Siberia if you make it. And that story is hardly ever told. The Soviets did that with basically all the camps they overran from Germany, POW camps, concentration camp, labor camps. Everybody was considered a collaborator for the Germans, which they basically were, because everybody in these camps worked for the Germans because they had to. They had not much of a choice. And the Soviets.
The Russians were. The Soviets were so bad that if you even practically were in the same territory as the Germans, they didn't trust you anymore, and they would just, you know, get rid
but
of you.
But now let me get back to my theme.
And also, I wish you would write that up, because that's okay. What we need in this.
27th of January used to be the birthday of the last German Kaiser, and was a national, not a national holiday, but it was celebrated in Germany until the end of First World War, when he was no longer the Kaiser. That used to be the 27th of January. Mm-hmm. And for those who have, who sometimes reminisce about the vanished old innocent Imperial Germany, the Second Reich, they think about that, and they used to commemorate the 18th of January, which was the formation of the Second Reich in 1871, and the 27th of January, because that was the birthday of the last Kaiser. And now, of course, that's wiped out, because now the 27th of January is Auschwitz and Holocaust Memorial Day. That sucks.
Yeah, that's great. That would be a fantastic article. And I wish you would, if you write it, and you could, you know, would also offer it to this website so we can put it on there, because it's perfect. And so there you have the Jewish people taking over, I mean, making their anniversaries and their days and the most important that there are, and taking over. Particularly in Germany, they're able to do that, right?
Right.
Oh, I just lost my...
You lost your line.
Yeah, I just lost my page. I think
I would have a couple. I would have a couple of negatives about that. About
Go
your
ahead.
Last statement.
Go ahead.
Yeah. It's not the Jewish people who do it. It's always special interests, Jewish special interests. And two, I just heard a dentist drill or something. And two, the other thing is not in a country that's overwhelmingly not Jewish. It's our responsibility. And, the idea.
Well, you're
that,
always saying that, Bradley. But you know, you're
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I am. I'm always saying that either. Because after all, we have to take responsibility for our failures, and stop blaming it on the other guy.
Who's responsible
really
for you not
to,
being?
We really have to see this as a weakness in Western culture, not a strength of the Jews, a weakness in our own culture and an unwillingness. Just like the American professoriate is overwhelmingly not Jewish, and yet they acquiesce in the Jewish narrative about the Holocaust. It's these acquiescence by ourselves that allows the other side to be so successful, and we need to address ourselves. I'm not.
Well, let me say here. Okay, let me say here to Germar, in that does he? I know I lost my point that I had there. Does he think that that this who is responsible for driving out the Second Reich that he thinks was the best government for Germany? Wasn't it the communists? Was it the German people who just let it happen? How did all that go down? You have to look at the details of how all this stuff goes down before you start blaming the European people for their weakness. What would you say to that, Germar?
Well, it's a complex issue. I mean, the whole thing is tied into World War I, which itself is a complex issue. And revolutionary forces, I mean, the whole communist thing was, of course, invented in Germany by Marx and Engels. So you can, of course, then look into their ethnic or religious affiliations or that of their families, and then we have the old story. Socialism has grown to power and recognition in Germany first before it went anywhere else. And that was opposed right from the start against the Second Reich, even though one must say that it changed dramatically when the First World War broke out, except for the extremists and the communists and the extreme socialists. The others then stood by the Kaiser Reich, by Germany, and saw that as a national cause. So things aren't clear cut. And I agree with Bradley. We have to make sure that we don't make sweeping accusations of the Jews. It's not every Jew. And there are a lot of non-Jews who try to be more Jewish than the Jews, or what they perceive to be more Jewish. And the Zionists...
I don't know, though, but I don't know a single Jew that does not... I do know a few.
Yeah, there are a few.
that say they're revisionists, but they don't go all the way with it. They only go part way because they don't want to blame.
No, you look at Paul Eisen. He goes all the way.
Yeah, he's the one I'm thinking of. He does not.
Mm-hmm.
He might go all the way with Holocaust, but he doesn't go all the way with how the Jews were treated in the Third Reich, and makes out that they shouldn't, none of that stuff should have happened to them, and that, you know, there's a lot of reasons why it did. So we probably need to drop that.
When Gilmore brings up World War One, I think that's very pertinent. World War One was, there is no more brutal, savage, stupid, inhumane activity that took place in the world in the last few centuries than World War One, and it took place between the leaders of Germany, France, the Germans, the French, and the Americans. You know, it wasn't this immense war brutal, savage, was fully in the hands of the Americans, the English, the German, and the French.
It wasn't fully. It wasn't.
Idea that,
it appeared to be fully, but there were powers behind the scene.
That's such a wimpish thing to say. The people who run the government, who do the drafts and send them into the...
They did run the government. These people did run the governments. If you look at the...
If they have some Jew on their back and do this and that, then they're weak. They're weak and stupid. And the thing is, what we got to do is clean up our own act. I mean, World War One is a perfect example of it. I mean, it was a stupid affair.
In retrospect, it's easy to say. I mean, all the small wars we had before between European powers or European powers against powers outside of Europe, most of these wars were driven by economic imperial interests. And the First World War in the outset was nothing different. It just happened to, at the end, involve everyone and take place in the heart of the imperial powers, whereas all the others were kind of peripheral. And you look into the deeper reasons they have been coming up for 20, 30 years, and they were economical in nature, such a huge expense, such a huge risk, everybody beating up everybody else, risking everything. They do it only if they think a lot is at stake, and a lot was at stake back then for the British Empire. If you look at the economic growth, Germany around the turn of the century, the 19th century to the 20th century, had an economic growth like China has it right now, and England had an economic growth like the United States has now. And at that time, there was no mutual nuclear annihilation threat. The countries were very close to each other. They were getting each other's way all the time. The Germans were out-competing and out-producing the British more and more everywhere. So the British had a choice. They had to either share their empire with Germany. You couldn't sell that to any Britishman after 200, 300 years of expansionism and dominating half of the world. The newcomers, Germans, they said it even. We want to rule with you. We want to help you, and we want our share of your empire. That was the economic position. The Germans were just producing the English against the wall. Still doing it today, by the way. It hasn't changed. All the two world wars for nothing. England is down the drain, and Germany is still producing. But England tried hard. They made propaganda in America to bring the American government, the American establishment against Germany. Pogroms were going on in America against ethnic Germans since the early 20th century, since 1905, 1906, 1907, because of the propaganda the British were doing in America to bring the American public and the American establishment up against Germany. So they were working at it for two decades before it actually happened. And it's an economic interest of England, and they brought everybody else on their side. France had revenge feelings for the lost war four decades earlier, and Russia, the Tsar. I would absolutely agree with Bradley when it comes to Russia. He really didn't have his act together. He had no business in there. He was living in Lala and Dreamland and got involved in something that was way too big, way out of his league, and that ended up in the revolution and communism. That was the biggest disaster.
Okay, well, let's not go. We can't solve all that, and we really wanted to talk about Holocaust, the situation today, and the upcoming commemoration. So that was very informative. But I would like to bring up that the story that I found today, because I'm looking for things about this commemoration coming up, and I don't find anything yet. But there was something today that the UN Chief Secretary General Ban Ki-moon attended a Shoah event at the New York Synagogue, at a New York Synagogue. And so here we have Bradley. You know, that this is everything that you read about this comes from Jewish newspapers. It's Jewish news services. It's Jews talking to Jews about what their Jewish interests. And you don't find much interest in all of this in this commemoration elsewhere. On Monday, and maybe on Sunday, there'll be stories about it everywhere, but that's it. It's not that interesting to non-Jewish people, but to the Jewish people, It is. And so Ban Ki-moon went to this New York synagogue, which for some reason was honoring this Holocaust Memorial Day today, on the 20th. And he spoke. I guess they're going to be busy next thing. No, it says on Saturday. He was there Saturday, not today. And he spoke at the Park East Synagogue, and he said some things, you know, the usual stuff. And let's see, I have...
I've read his stuff.
You know what he says. But it says that he's talking about...
No American friend will challenge him. One American at the UN, the United Nations, will challenge
him. Of course not. They support all that. They're in support of all that. They're totally, you know, treasonous people in our government, if you ask me. So, so there, you know, he's saying that the cruelty was so profound in the Holocaust, it's hard to grasp, you know, and the Nazi worldview was so warped and extreme, yet attracted so many followers. They're making out. See, their whole thing is to make out that the Nazis were.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, they're pretty successful at it, and they're very united. They're very united.
So that's all I found from there. And then let's see what else I've got here. Oh well, what do you think of this? Israel, this is not brand new news, but it's kind of new. That Israel is moving toward passing a law to ban the word Nazi in Israel. And they're going to stop.
I read that yesterday. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why do you think they're doing this? They want to stop the use of all Nazi symbols in expressing remorse for the fall of the Nazi regime, and calling somebody a Nazi will be illegal. And, And they're going to also ban the use of the Jewish Star of David when used in reference to the Holocaust. So I guess it's contaminating their Star of David and so on.
They need to control the story. They have to control the story because it's full of crapola. They need to. I think I was talking to Germar the other day, and I was thinking somebody ought to recommend Mabala, get him into the revisionist movement. Get him, ask him for his help against all this stuff.
Well, what help would he give? Does he know anything about it besides making jokes about it? I'm not against him or anything.
No, it's a way. He has a way of addressing the public. I mean, he has success, people listening to him and rallying to his support. And he has a way, of course, of finding the attention of the masses, and that's helpful.
Yeah, that's something that we're trying to do, and we're failing at it.
Well, he's a friend of Robert Faurisson's. So, if there was anything going there, that they would be, Robert Faurisson would be getting him into it.
Yeah,
well,
coming back to why Israel outlaws the use of the word Nazi outside of the historical reference, it's very clear. I mean, they are hell-bent on keeping the Holocaust and everything connected to it as something unique.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are always outraged if somebody used the word Holocaust in some other connection, be it the Holocaust of abortion or the Holocaust of the slaughter of whales or whatever people can come up with. There's always an outcry. How can you desecrate the term Holocaust? It's reserved. It has a copyright on it, a trademark. And it's the same with Nazi. You know, trying to insult somebody as a Nazi who lives today, and in particular in Israel, is like trivializing the concept that they want to be as a term of absolute evil applicable only to the Germans of that era. That's important for them.
That's why this gesture of Mabala has initiated. I don't know how to say it. Canel, this thing of the right arm down, or one arm down, and the other across the chest. That's why that's so controversial. because it's something that anyone can do. He doesn't have to know anything. He doesn't have to know anything about Holocaust, Jews, Israel, or anything, but specifically. But he knows what the situation is. You know, everybody knows that you don't talk about these things. But yet these guys can make this gesture and create a firestorm of controversy by using this gesture. I mean, it's like an art form.
Well, that's the thing, though. You know, they don't know anything. And so how that brings up to my to me a question that I have, in that how important is it for people to know very much, you know, in the actual questions about Holocaust, why it's not true, why the stories are incorrect and so on, or just to be against it. A lot of these people, they just don't like Jews in France. Because I saw a picture of the bunch of people doing the canal that actually Robert Butt sent out. And it was all non-white people. I mean, it was
I would say if you want to be obscene, you use the middle finger. If you don't want to be obscene in France, you use the canal. And it has kind of the same symbolic in the meantime. It has little to do with anything. It's just anti-establishment. They want to rile. They want to provoke. And for many people, that's not much more to it. Of course.
Yeah, and it doesn't help us either. It doesn't really help us.
Well, you know what? The thing is, it's anti-establishment. But we're talking about an issue here at which, in the intellectual and public world, the establishment is a Jewish Holocaust establishment. And so, therefore, these people, without the benefit of knowing how many holes were in the roof of Crematory II, they're challenging this establishment on the street, like we're challenging it in journals.
Mm-hmm. Some of them. I have the impression there are too many out there. Not all of them can have an idea what it really means. Some of them just have an instinct of rebellion, of contrarianism.
Well, why is Holocaust revisionism important to the world, and especially to Europeans, which we need to get liberated? We do need to be liberated from this Holocaust narrative. And also us in America, European people. Why is it important? There are those, you know, who say and argue that we can just leave it alone. It doesn't matter. We need to move forward and trying to strengthen ourselves as a people, in the sense that Bradley's talking about, and build up our ability to stand up for ourselves in this very multicultural world now, where we're becoming more and more of a minority. I know everybody doesn't think the same way, but so I'm not trying to emphasize that white aspect of it, but just, you know, how Europeanism seems to be under attack quite a bit, the European culture. And how important is the Holocaust revisionism to that?
Well, the first thing to say about that, from my point of view, is this, is that it is, and we're all aware of this, I'm not saying anything unique here, that the Holocaust story is the basis for the U.S. Congress arming and paying the Israeli state to abuse Palestinian and the Muslim peoples wherever it can. If the Holocaust story falls apart, the U.S. Congress, there's a chance that the U.S. Congress will begin to behave not only like human beings, but like Americans, rather than be committed to a foreign state.
Do you think it's possible for the Holocaust story to fall apart?
Excuse me?
Yeah, do you think it's possible for the Holocaust story to fall apart?
Oh yeah, sure. Sooner or later, it's not going to disintegrate. But the thing is it's going to be challenged more and more and more and more. The irony, and I've said this before, is that not only is the story being institutionalize more and more deeply, but the revisionist reaction to the story and the criticism of the story is also growing. You know, both sides of the thing are growing. And sooner or later, the Holocaust can't hold in the long run, but it looks like it's going to take a long time because we, and I'm talking about the American people, you know, we're not ready to do it yet. We prefer to put Israel first and not America.
What do you think, Germar, to that question, Willett?
I think Arthur Butts has answered this question a long time ago when he was talking about the Holocaust controversy in our times. We need to step back, think out of the box, and look at a historical parallel. The Catholic Church in the medieval times had certain historical myths and lies built up as a control mechanism to basically rule the world. And we have a similar situation here. There is an establishment that controls the world with political, with financial instruments, with psychological instruments, and the Holocaust is one main control mechanism in it to shoo anyone away from touching certain taboos that would undermine this power basis. You need to just look, and anyone who dares challenge nowadays dogmas and just use the financial world is going to get shut down. All the Nazis did the same thing. They challenged interests. They challenged this. You know, you can easily call somebody a Nazi if he goes anyway by argument that can be claimed to be
okay.
Something. And then
okay, we're going to our break. You know, I'm going to continue this, Germar, when we get back, and we'll let you continue on with what you're saying. I'm going to bring this up again as soon as we get back from the break. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay with us for a 5-minute break.
Thank you.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday night. This is the Heretics Hour on January 20th, 2014. And I have with me Guillermo Rudolph and Bradley Smith, two well-known gentlemen involved in Holocaust revisionism. And that's what our subject is tonight. And when we went on the break, Guillermo was speaking, and Bradley had given some comments about there's two questions here. How important is the Holocaust? Or why is the Holocaust important to our future well-being? Ending really the Holocaust narrative. And also, what are the prospects for that being accomplished? So, Guillermo, you want to continue with where you were with that?
Yes. Bradley focused on the conflict in the Middle East, and I think that is most certainly the most obvious and immediate impact it would have. But talking about Europeans, we're talking about the normal man. They're not too much concerned about what's happening in Palestine. They should be, but they aren't. It's an illusion to think that they would be by the millions so upset about it that they would stage a revolution, because nothing short of that would be required to change things peacefully or otherwise. So what we are looking at is anti-establishment in a much wider perspective. If you look at Europe in particular right now, they have financial problems. And the United States has some too, but in Europe they're more apparent because historically seen they have always had separate currencies and now they have one together and nothing works anymore. Suddenly it turns out that they have this many-headed hydra of interest and compounded interest that pulls down every nation and a big mess. And what they need is a radical look into how to restructure the financial system that things like that don't happen, because it's a massive redistribution from poor to rich and from poor country to rich countries. And this is causing a lot of trouble. And the establishment, of course, wants to keep a lid on that. And if you want to look into anything historically that has tried to combat this kind of flow of finance because of rigged interest systems and what have you, you end up inevitably looking into something that the Nazis tried to implement, because Germany, after the First World War, was in the situation. It was the country that was being plundered by the interest system, not just the Versailles Treaty, but an awful lot of more of this. Also internally, a redistribution of wealth. The Nazis all blamed it on the Jews, but that was a little bit too simple. But they had solutions for that had nothing to do with getting rid of the Jews, but changing the interest system on an international level with their way of trading and. So even if you don't go the way and say, okay, I'll look into this and see what they did that worked, because the whole world was in financial crisis and only Germany rose out of the ashes under the Nazis, which they did, you can't say it. Even if you don't say it, stay completely away from it, still make a radical criticism of the financial system as we have it. Somebody will come up in the establishment and say, you try to argue the way the Nazis did, and that's the end of the discussion.
Yes, but may I just bring in here for you to consider that in saying that it's not the Jews doing this, when it comes to the financial system, that is, wouldn't you say that is the symbol of Jewish power and also Jewish privilege that goes along with it? What you're talking about is Jewish privilege, which you can't say anything that the Jews don't like. You know, if you say anything decent about Nazis, well, they can't handle that, and you can't say anything bad about them, and you can't say anything the way things actually were because the Jews don't like it. And that's Jewish privilege, and it shows who's
even if you don't say anything, you make a radical critique of the financial system, and you don't mention anything about Jews or their dominance in certain actors, you will still be accused of being anti-Semitic, because it is understood that everybody understands that they have a dominant role in this sector. Mm-hmm. So even if you try to stay out of it, you can't. Right. So the legitimacy of criticizing the role of that minority and their own agenda is impossible with the Holocaust cork sitting in the bottle.
All right.
So in general, that has an impact way beyond Palestine. You know, why does Israel dictate foreign policy of the United States? Only because the Jews in the United States have so much political, financial, and psychological leverage. Right. And not just in America. I mean, they have it basically in all Western countries and in many non-Western countries too. So criticizing, naming the fact is the first step. You can't do that already. Criticizing is the next step. You won't even get there. So that has an impact on politics on an international level, imperialistic politics, imperialistic financial politics.
How can the Holocaust myth be brought down? Bradley was saying it could be. And you said, like the Catholic Church was it that you were saying that, weren't you?
Well, Gammer? I was quoting Arthur Butz, and yeah. What he said basically is, as long as the interest of the majority of the establishment of the ruling class is on the side of the myth, it's not going to work. As soon as the system has come to the point where it can't be recovered anymore, where people face the reality, something radical has to change, and then certain sectors of the establishment break off, like it happened with Martin Luther and thereon, Germany falling off the papacy, and then other countries went Protestant and so forth. That was slowly but surely the end of the power of the Catholic Church. It had come to that point only because Catholic Church had abused its power so much that it was apparent for even many people in the establishment that this was untenable and they just didn't go along anymore. So you have to reach that point here too, that you have to get in the world to the point where a number of countries that are powerful enough that they can't be bullied into submission anymore or bombed into submission, that a critical mass can be achieved for things to change.
Well, does it have to be a country? Can we reach enough people, individual people, and get them talking enough and get them not buying into this anymore, although still the number that do is so far greater than the number that don't. I mean, when you think about all
one
these
of the
people out there.
Out of this is that, listen, one of the reasons Jewish influence is so powerful in Western culture is that Western culture is based on Jewish narratives from the Old Testament. The idea that U.S. Congress would support Israel over the interests of the United States is largely rooted in Christian culture, not in Jewish culture. It's interested in the both, because there is no, without Christianity in the United States, Jews would be like they are in Yemen. They wouldn't have near the importance that they have now. So this isn't just a Jewish issue. This is a Jewish Christian cultural issue in which it isn't Jews and it's not Christians. It's both. And the thing is that you don't have to understand the whole history of it. Right now, the U.S. Congress supports the Israeli state against all of the Muslims surrounding it.
Okay, let's...
You don't have to be a...
Yeah, well, we know that. Let's not get into Palestine if we can help it, because it just takes so much time. I just took... I'm sorry, Bradley, if I'm stopping you. Go ahead and make your point.
I introduced the issue of Christianity supporting the Jewish program.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is that when we attack Jews, we leave the Christian aspect of it out, and the Christian aspect of Jewish influence in Western culture is overwhelming. It's overwhelming.
Well, I think I've got somebody on the line here who called in. Are you on the line, caller?
I am.
Well, make it.
Hey, I say something.
Oh, this is Frederick. I knew it wasn't from the United States. We've got Fred Tobin on the line.
We have a small revisionist conference here going on.
Yes, okay. Well, all right, Fred, go ahead.
Hi, Fred.
G'day. How you going? Look, while we're talking about this topic, I thought it'd be interesting just to mention this to the listener, that we had the Wagner Ring in Melbourne just in November, December. And accompanying the production, the three-cycle episode, was a symposium on Wagner. And, of course, instead of discussing the music, and which is attached to all that as an expression of a mindset, there were individuals who wanted to turn this whole symposium into an anti-Semitism matter. In other words, they're not discussing Wagner's output, but they're trying to hold of it, because Wagner was a skull-splitting genius who created this massive work of musical drama and whatever. And by using the word anti-Semitism or racism, both of those two were used, the whole discussion disintegrated or refocused onto the Jewish problem. And John Dethridge, he's the expert on Wagner and anti-Semitism. We had the final session was a round table discussion. There were four people on the panel, and whenever I put my hand up, you could imagine the two roaming microphones wouldn't come my way. Because before that, in an earlier session, a woman who talked about Theodore Adorno's concept of Wagner and so on, I had asked her, because she said Adorno was a great philosopher, I had asked her what actually did he produce. And I said in my final to that episode, I said that Adorno needs Wagner in order to produce good, but Wagner would never have needed Adorno. And I found in the audience of 50 or 60 people, there were plenty who were interested in hearing my point of view. In other words, focusing on Wagner and leaving the Jewish issue out of it. And now, in this final round of discussion, John Dethridge ended the session, I remember it was 22-3, and his final words were anti-Semitism and racism. And so I had my hand up for the 20 minutes remaining before 3 o'clock, and it didn't come. So at 2:02, I said to myself, should I or shouldn't I get up and something, because the microphone wasn't coming my way. So at 2:02, it was very quiet, and I just stood up and said, John, if you're going to talk about racism in order to balance the equation, you'll have to also mention the racism contained in the Jewish Babylonian Talmud. And there was deafening silence for half a minute, nothing happened, and then they closed the meeting. Now, this indicated to me that although I had sympathetic understanding coming my way in that earlier question, this one was too big, and individuals didn't dare raise the issues, which I raised with two or three others during breaks.
But what you're saying, Fred, that's important, I think, is that when you have something like a Wagner symposium, then the Jewish element takes it and turns it into something that is in their interest and about them, rather than really about Wagner.
Isn't that what you're saying here. Yeah, this is exactly what you're pointing out again and again. The elements that give rise to an impulse and are brilliant are then hijacked by someone else.
But why can it happen? Why can it happen? I think we have to come
because don't only blame the Jews, also blame those who bend to their pressure.
Yes, but you know, we're also proud. What will happen when you don't do it? What will happen when you speak out? Bad things happen to people.
If I go back to what Bradley had said, and take that a little further, and let me make a radical approach here.
I can only mention Wilhelm Stekely, whom I met in 97, and he said quite clearly, if there are 100 judges who are not going, for example, in Germany, who are not prepared to enforce Section 130, then that thing would disappear. And therefore, it's a matter of education, and that's what the revisionists are doing.
Okay.
If I may step back a little here again, tell from my own history. I have been raised Catholic, and I understand that in America, most people are raised in a Christian faith, and it doesn't matter whether it's Catholic or any of the Protestant denominations. And you grow up, and you read the Bible, and you read about the Jews being the chosen people, and you don't think great things about it, but the Jews are there, and as positive as the founding stone upon which Christianity was built, and it is part of the Christian faith. Now, if I look at the difference between Europe today, where there is a popular underground movement that's making the canal, and it's not just happening. It just happened in the Belgian parliament that one of the parliamentarians there came up and did it. So it's spreading. Of course, Belgium is half Francophone. The difference between America and Europe is that Europe, the originally Christian population, half of it, if not more, has been secularized. In other words, they are not Christian anymore. They're kind of agnostic or atheist. And you have a massive Muslim immigrant population that is now 10, 15, 20% of the population, which don't necessarily have the same burden of thinking of Jews necessarily as chosen people as well. Whereas in America, you still have a 80%, 90% in the Bible Belt, or if you go outside of it, still a majority of people who consider themselves Christians and who practice in one way or another. And if I may say here, Christianity is a Jewish sect. And as long as the United States is the world power and 70, 80, 90% of it are Jews, Christians understood as a Jewish sect, it's not going to change.
Yes, but this is where we then have to expose the thinking behind this. And I think Horst Mahler did this quite well when he began with the Hegelian dialectic. And I put in the Talmudic Marxist feminist death dialectic in opposition. And this is, of course, at a level very few people they don't really want to get involved in this. When I start like this, I know friends switch off and say, oh, there you go again, your bloody dialectic. But it is interesting, in America, I noticed, those who want to knock the Germans, they'll say, oh, the Hegelian dialectic. They do not differentiate between the life-giving Hegelian dialectic and the Talmudic Marxist one, where one is friend-foe, win-lose, the other one is win-win, and so on. But it's all there. It's all out there in America, and I just hope that the First Amendment will not be broken or split up into this, you know, free expression, free speech, hate speech, which isn't happening in Australia.
That's what they're trying to do. And for Bradley to say Bradley's a big free speech advocate, and yet there are some exceptions, but in general, the Jews will go along with banning free speech if it's hate speech. They want to distinguish between those things.
But so do the Christians.
Yeah, and once you do that,
Christians go along with it. They don't know what else to do but to
Christians
go along with it.
That's right. Christians go along with it.
Are you along
with it.
as long as you accept the Old Testament as a legitimate part of what you call a holy book, you're trapped and you will not
get out. Yeah, well, I would throw out the Old Testament myself. So how many people here are atheists? I mean, how many, is anybody here amongst the four of us, if, I'm not going to include myself, amongst the three of you,
I consider myself an agnostic. I left the church in 96.
Okay.
I am not an atheist. An atheist is a true believer, just like a Catholic.
It's okay. Just an anti-believer.
Okay.
That's why I say I'm an agnostic. I say I don't know, and there's no way of knowing. That's what I say.
The atheist knows no more about God.
I think by saying you're an atheist, people are actually denying the existence of life itself. And therefore, you have to... For example, the famous atheists running around at the moment, Dawkins and so on, they are atheists. They don't believe in a creation in God, but they believe in the Holocaust. And this is fatal. Remember, Adolf Hitler used to say, the godliness, in other words, the element, if you're with nature, then you are, in fact, in connection with the Creator. And the fact that we are actually in existence indicates we have been created. Therefore, the atheistic left-wing Marxist element is actually being fueled by those who further condemn the German cultural endeavors.
Okay. Well, Frederick, where do you stand with Christianity? How do you describe yourself?
Well, I was
fortunate. I was born in 1944 in Germany, and I was not christened because we were the new generation. We were Gottgläubig, God-believing.
Yes.
And this would have then continued in 2-3 generations. It would have jettisoned anything that came out of Rome or Jerusalem. And I've said this publicly. I appreciate what came out there, but for me, it is not for me because... I sense, if I look at the natural phenomena while traveling around Königsberg especially, I mean, it's a romantic notion as well, but then I feel quite at home there.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
You asked me where I was with Christianity. The thing is, I actually have a very short anecdote to tell. When I was a boy, I was in Korea. I was a rifleman, and one day in a valley in North Korea, I got shot in the head. And I managed to find my way to a canal full of water, and I'm there, and I noticed the guy up on the other end of the ditch where we were was doing something with his hands. And it turns out he was a Catholic from Brooklyn. He was saying his beads. I said, "Charlie, are you doing your beads?" He says, "You're goddamn right I'm doing my beads." And at that moment, I realized that I didn't believe in God. And I never struggled over the issue. I was raised a Christian. I never struggled over it, but it happened to me. I got shot in the head. I was in a ditch full of water, and I realized that I was alone with the other guys in the squad, and that I didn't believe that God was nothing for me. And I never changed my mind.
It's a miracle that you're still alive.
You have all these experiences with your inner self, your spirit, and so on. And
that wasn't my inner self. That was a book inside of the head.
Well, but I mean, you know, you have this relationship with yourself.
Yeah.
That you've always had. It's very, very strong, you know.
Had a fair sometimes.
Yeah. Well, okay, so
Is this Frederick Tobin?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed.
It is?
The big yeah. Frederick. The
I didn't understand that.
Dr. Frederick.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
I just want to live in Thailand.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, well, here we are. This brings me to a story I had here from the news that the Pope is considering going to unseal the Vatican archives on Pius the 22nd. And that's because he has this Jewish friend, rabbi friend from Argentina, who is actually where this news has come from. And this, again, is another Jewish newspaper, the Forward, or I don't know, but it's one of them.
And it's Haaretz. Haaretz is a better newspaper than the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's more honest about Jews, New York Times.
Well, but the Jews put this information out that nobody, you don't see anywhere else, you know, because it hasn't happened yet, but they promote this stuff that they want the other Jews who are reading, this is from the Times of Israel, they want all the Jews to know that they have a lot of influence with the Catholic Church and with the Pope, and they really like to promote that kind of thinking.
But it confirms Germa's point, doesn't it? That there is this nexus between the two, and if you read Adelaide Institute's newsletter 735, going up soon, you'll notice also that they're trying to criminalize the word Nazi in Israel.
Oh yeah, and we talked about that. Circle. We talked about that before you called.
It's interesting. It's come full circle, you know. And so it is. It's in some ways it's a blessing that we can watch these developments still.
Well, right. So what do you, you know? I imagine these archives. Probably the Pope doesn't think the archives are going to show Pius guilty of anything. But here's when you said that this is always, you know, the Catholic Church didn't used to be like this, and the Catholic Church didn't used to have to worry about what the Jews thought of them. But now. What we see all the time is that, well, they have to get along with what the Jews, and they have to satisfy the Jewish religion, so and so on, and therefore they have to produce and they have to prove that they are in no way helped out in the Holocaust. In fact, they hope that this will show that Pius was trying very hard to save Jews and so on. See, this is just a kowtowing that the church is at now, partially because it's more of a universal church. This is an Argentinian pope, and it could be in the future there would be an African pope. I mean, you know, that's where things are going, and I don't think that is good for not only us European people, but it's not good for the whole all peoples. Anybody have a comment on that?
Well, the thing is if you're not a believer in the Catholic faith, which most people are not, then it's not going to be seen as a catastrophe. When you look back, when you look at the history of warfare in Western Europe during the Catholic reign of more than 1,000 years, you'll find out that it was bloody, savage, primitive, ugly, and absolutely, with respect to right relationship, absolutely wrong. It was like a preview for World War I. And the thing is that what did the Pope say about the murder of hundreds of thousands of civilians in Dresden, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Hamburg. What public
good,
exclamation
good
were
point.
Made about the
good point? I don't know of any.
Inhumane acts. Huh?
Good point, Bradley. I don't know of anything that was said.
There you go. So what's when the Catholic Church behaves in such a way with respect to the slaughter carried on by its own quote unquote people. Why should we be focused on Jews?
From what's been said so far, how do we get things back on track? Not through the religions, according to you guys, but how do we get things back on a track where we can where people will accept the true story of what happened during the so-called Holocaust time?
Well, as I said,
one thing I can do, let me say this, the one thing I can try to do is to be in right relationship with those with whom I come in contact. So.
Well, that's fine. But what about, that's for the religious part. But what about getting the
Holocaust? That isn't from a religious part. That's from just from a simple, a very simple, ordinary human place.
Okay. All right. So, Germar.
Well, what we personally can do, I think it isn't going to have a major impact. What we can do is prepare the information for the time when people are willing to latch onto it. And the time will come. I see it preparing in Germany. As I said, it's getting secularized. People don't consider themselves Christian anymore. They don't see the Bible anymore as a holy book. And for them, the Jews are just an entity of anyone else. And that has to happen. Jews have to be a normal people like everyone else, measured by the same standard, and that works in Europe, where Muslim masses are taken over and where the Christian population falls off their beliefs and believes in nothing anymore. And when you have reached that state, that's when you reach the tipping point, when people are actually willing. They don't have the religious taboo implanted into their brains anymore since childhood. They can actually look outside the box. They can look without pink glasses, or whatever you want to call them. Here in the United States, when it comes to getting rid of these religious taboos, it's taking longer. The United States is a century. I mean, the United States was basically, for the initial centuries, founded by religious zealots.
But wait a minute.
And we still have them.
Besides, you get into that. What I hear you saying is that when we stop being Christian and we have all the Muslims taking over in Europe and the people are no longer have any, European people have no religion, they're also not going to have the power in their nations, then maybe, the Holocaust will lose its power. Maybe, maybe the work of that will have been done then, because
I didn't say I like it. I said that's the development. And I'm not going to see anyone stopping the Muslim invasion and the Muslimification in Europe.
Well, I can't.
The problem, if you look, is the problem is already, for example, at the United Nations, where this declaration against any forms of glorifying Nazism was signed by Iran and Israel, and among others. And this means that the impulse that Hitler began against the financial system, and I call Adolf Hitler now a real 20th century freedom fighter. He was the original freedom fighter of the 20th century, who fought not against the Jews as such, but against, as Germa said, against the financial system. And this financial system is breaking down. And as Germa indicated before, when I started listening in, this is where we have to have, where the people who are interested in changing things, they have to have their program ready. It has to be nurtured. It has to be done, as small groups in Germany are doing. But at the moment, there's not much life coming through. But I know that traditionally in Germany, for example, the young people are again singing folk songs. The girls are wearing trachten, the folk costumes, and the men are wearing lederhosen again. Gamma, when are you going to wear yours?
I don't know which part of Germany you have seen recently, but this is such a tiny minority.
That's the way I see it, too.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the evolutionary approach of having Muslim invasion and the Germans and the Europeans losing their faith. And then there's the revolutionary approach that comes at the moment when the financial system collapses, or when it puts such pressure and burden
You still have to have that national entity, or in fact a European entity.
Yeah.
And in time, there are theoreticians working this out.
Is that your phone, Frederick, that's beeping?
Oh, that's my phone. It's running out of battery.
Yeah. It just keeps beeping. Okay. I want to bring some attention.
Let the euro collapse, it comes. The writing is on the wall. It's only a matter of time. This compounded interest system can't go on eternally. It's going to collapse. Some of the European countries, we go on the barricades, the people there, because they can't take it, they won't take it anymore. And when the euro goes down, it is too big not to drag other currencies down. Then we may have a chain reaction that brings the whole system down, including the euro, the US dollar and what have you. And then things get completely mixed up and everything's open.
Well, if you really think that, if you really see that, it sounds, you know, it sounds encouraging. I mean, I would like to see the euro.
I don't know. Well, I'd rather.
You know, would anybody be prepared to do the right thing when that happened, or would we go into a total police state scenario? Well, so I don't think.
You better have a farm in the family.
The police state is being prepared.
Yeah, this is pretty bad. Well, let me just go back to the website and point out, because somebody brought up how the UN and its ban on revisionism. But, you know, at the bottom of the first of the opening page of the site, the home page, there is this article written in 2005, as part of it, by Robert Faurisson on the UN, why this UN resolution came about. That is from the January 27th commemoration. He says the UN decides a universal ban on revisionism. So, you know, this was done in 2000. This commemoration was set up in 2005, began in 2006. And this year is the ninth year. Next year will be the 10th year. And I can tell already that they have some big plans for next year, because it will be the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, which now they're calling, I noticed, they're starting to call it, I looked on the Auschwitz-Birkenau website and their write-up about this commemoration this year, and they're starting to call it the liberation of Europe. See, they don't want it to be just the liberation of Auschwitz, because there's so many problems with Auschwitz now. So now they want to, but they have to keep this January 27th. But the funny thing is that it's still that date, January 27th, which was the so-called, you know, liberation of Auschwitz. But they're still calling it the commemoration for the liberation of Europe. So any comment on that? I mean, how they're shifting this around.
Yeah, they want to get as many nations on board as they can. Tell the Hungarians, tell the Estonians, Lithuanians, they were so glad that they finally threw off the Soviet yoke after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they thought, now we have liberty, now we can celebrate our nationhood, our history, and commemorate our oppression. And now they experienced, the Ukrainians and the Baltic states, they experienced the German army as a liberator and the Soviet as the ultimate oppressor. And they have to tell the story now upside down. Could the Red Army liberate anyone? No, they couldn't. It's an absolute ridiculous statement. And you see here a parallel of the current historical narrative, how it is being interpreted, being identical to the Soviet narrative, the big lie that the whole Eastern Bloc was aware of, they had to recitate over and over again for 70 years or 50 years or whatever it was. And now we're back to that point that these communist Soviet lies via the pressure from not just Jewish sources are being forced down our throats again.
The most interesting thing to me that's come out tonight is this thing, because I'm really interested in the whole idea of this liberation of Auschwitz by the Soviet Red Army. And first you're talking about the rapes and how they sent the inmates there to gulags in Siberia and so on. And now you just said they were incapable of liberating anyone. What were you meaning by that? That Red Army couldn't liberate anyone and didn't?
Well, the Red Army was the most brutal army that ever existed. That fought for a government that was the ultimate evil dictatorship. I mean, look at when the war broke out, the Second World War broke out. You could even say the war between Nazi Germany, or National Socialist Germany, and the Soviet Union. You can say that by that time, Hitler and his people had killed how many people? Hundreds, apart from war casualties. But the Soviet Union in peacetime had killed millions, and it kept on going after that. So how can anyone think that Red Army can liberate anyone? They couldn't. They put the yoke on wherever they put their boots, people would be incarcerated in the big prison called Soviet Union and their satellite states.
You're right. Caroline. You're absolutely right.
Listen, Caroline.
Yes.
If you need a new refocus, then I got this off Gamma because he indicated to me, and I became aware of it, that January 27th is also the Emperor.
He talked about that already. You know, you didn't listen to the rest of the program, the first part of the program, we already did that.
Therefore, we have to get back to the monarchical system.
Okay, all right.
And
let's go on. Okay, Frederick.
Idea.
let's go on with I'd like to stick with the commemoration thing now, and I really like this about the Red Army being too brutal to do this. And I had a thought, now I've lost it. I have to say things right away or I don't remember them. But all right. The other big issue that should be brought up in regards to Holocaust is the fact that Britain and the United States allied with Stalin and the Soviet Union, which you just mentioned, Garmar, how they had already murdered millions and millions and millions and had this horrible, everybody knew how horrible they were, and then they allied with them because they wanted to they made out that Germany was the bigger threat. This does not hold up at all, does it?
No, it makes no sense. Germany has not been the bigger threat, not for individuals, not for minority groups, not for any nations. The Soviet Union has always been the bigger threat. The question is, why did they do it anyway? Britain was at that time caught up in the thinking of the First World War. For them, it was just a continuation. They didn't manage to finish off Germany as the most threatening, what they consider the most threatening competitor for world market dominance or whatever they were seeing in Germany. And for America, just look at the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, which was crypto-communist. So you have the Soviet Union, the Union of Socialist Soviet Republics in Russia, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics or states in the United States working together. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a crypto-communist with the whole administration, and they're working hand-in-hand with the Soviet Union to do their thing. That was ideologically driven, but for America, there was a lot of economic interests. I mean, they started in the First World War to punch out Britain and replace them as the world power, and they finished it off with the Second World War. Germany was a very strong competitor. They had an interest together with England to push Germany off to the side and take over the British Empire. And of course, as I said, crypto-communist, the whole administration, and therefore they were completely blind No, they weren't blind. They were seeing it, but they were very friendly toward the communist idea. I mean, the information they received of what's going on in Stalin's Russia and what they did to suppress, by censorship, by intimidation, to suppress reports of what's going on in Russia in the American media, to which length the administration went to keep the American public in the dark, shows that they knew, wanted nobody to find out, and were collaborating anyway. So you had this administration, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, was criminal to the highest degree.
Okay.
Hold on,
Frederick. I think did Bradley just call back in?
Yeah, I got back in here.
Okay, I'm glad I answered that. I finally realized that was probably you because you were gone. Okay,
a lot of people tell me. They're always telling me I'm gone.
No, I don't mean that. Well, what do you think about what, did you hear what Garamar was saying about, I think this is a real important, and I think this should be brought out quite a bit.
I did not. I've lost the last 5 or 6 minutes.
Okay. Well, you know, we talked. Okay, Fred. Yeah. What?
Listen, what I found out only recently from an 85-year-old soldier was that in 45, before in April, he was part of the a German contingent of soldiers imprisoned in Schleswig-Holstein. They had already been put into British Army uniform, ready to be sent back to fight the Soviets. And he told me that just recently, that then there was the meeting of the three great ones, and everything fell apart.
Winston Churchill saw it. He finally understood he slaughtered the wrong pig, and he was ready to put the entire German army into the English army and keep marching east and try to
He woke up a little late, what month and year would you say he saw that,
April 45 the fellow just
already
came through Berlin. He escaped that cordon around Berlin because the military police prevented any soldiers from running towards the west, and he made it to Schleswig-Holstein. He was incarcerated and then put in British uniform.
Oh, you're talking about this man. I'm talking about Churchill. Garamar said that Churchill saw the truth and realized he had been wrong. I have a hard time believing this guy ever saw the truth, but he'd like history to think so later on. But what, Garamar, when was this supposed to have been?
That was at the very end of the war, and they were considering to keep the fight up against the Soviets, turn against the Soviets. Now, it was called off by the Americans, who were still allies and friendly, under Truman even. It took the Berlin crisis for things to turn around. Basically, Truman wasn't too familiar with what was going on. And he was basically continuing the policy of Roosevelt, and only slowly, particularly when it comes to Europe. Eisenhower was sitting there, and he was a
monster.
Well, German hater, basically, and he wouldn't concede anything that he ever, considering ever that he had made a mistake, so he wouldn't do that.
Eisenhower was also buddy. With Morgenthau and other Jews.
Yeah.
He was surrounded with Jews. That's what he preferred.
Yeah.
So, there's that again. Well, so what we're saying, what you're saying is that for Britain, it was economic, but for America, it was basically that they were communists too and were wanting to.
Well, it was economic. Getting the more competitors you can get out of the race, the better you are faring afterwards. It was about taking over the British Empire, and it was about having a crypto-communist administration.
Okay.
So we have these three factors in America.
Well, when, you know, Eisenhower has this reputation for being such a good president, and he, you know, blah, blah. He didn't do much, but if he was so anti-German, did he change any, in your opinion, during those 8 years that he was president of the United States? Or was he the same person?
During the war, if you look at his career, he made a military career more for political reasons than for military achievements. Others would have deserved being in his place when it comes to military achievements. That was a political assignment he got from his buddy.
Yeah, Roosevelt, makes sense.
And so because he was going down the very same road, ideologically seen. But after the Cold War had kicked off, it was a completely different ballgame. And once the new enemy was called the Soviet Union and the Cold War, everybody in the establishment jumped on that bandwagon. Germany was no factor anymore, and during his two administrations, that was not an issue. Germany was a poodle, an attack poodle, if you will, in case the Cold War would go hot, and that was all they were interested in and was working. So by that time, there was nothing left of animosity because things had just panned out the way he wanted it.
But all of this should be pointed out, that these stupid leaders of these countries, you know, who teamed up with Stalin.
Wait a minute. The Soviet Union disappeared. America dominates the globe and has for so many decades controlled world financial and economic markets. Why was it stupid? It worked out.
What I mean is they were saying
Americans.
We're friends with these people, and then suddenly, oh, we're not. Now we're enemies with these people. If they were worth, you know, fighting with and destroying Germany, and then a few months later, it was all turned around in Germany. They're friendly, more friendly with Germany, although they were controlling it totally.
In the first half of the 20th century, Germany was the economically and many sectors, financially, economically, and if you look into inventions, Nobel Prize of Science, was a leading power, and it was a growing in power. And
well, you know what? You know, one thing is that the United States was the greatest beneficiary of all the genius and technology of National Socialist Germany. And
yes,
they got all that. And that's what helped
them
over.
Yeah. So got the biggest competitor out of the race. First, in the First World War, you made England dependent financially and therefore basically taking over the empire, and you finished the job in the Second World War. In the Second World War, Germany got completely crushed. You could take over. And then the Cold War, you crushed the Soviet Union. And now the next target is China. And I think that is going to be a little bit too big a bite to take, so it's not going to happen. That will probably be America's downfall. Just look at the financial economic.
Well, here we are. We've just got a few minutes left, and I feel like probably Bradley didn't get enough time to talk. So, Bradley, has what's been said up till now has brought any thoughts into your mind that you'd like to express?
No, I was actually listening to it, just like your other listeners. I'm okay here. I don't feel like I was left out. I'm okay.
Okay. Well, have you looked at the website? Do you think it will be?
I just found it a few minutes before we came on the air. I think it's a lot of work, Carolyn. You're a workaholic. You're like Guillermo.
I'm not as smart as Guillermo though, because he can do about three times or four times as much as I can do in the same amount of time. So, but anyway, Guillermo helped quite a bit, and I want to point out. Some of these, there are on there, but there's some good articles on Codo called by Guillermo and Carlo Matonio on the holes in the gas chamber at Bear Canal, The Elusive Holes of Death, and No Holes, No Gas Chamber by Carlo Matonio, and The Openings for the Introduction of Zyklon B, The Opening. All this great information is there. People would go and I suppose if they just search for these names, Guillermo Rudolph and Carlo Matonio, they'll come up with everything that's on there by them, right?
Yeah, well, the easiest way is they have an author index. They just click on it, pick the initial of the author you want, and then you get the author there, and you have the list of all the papers that were written by them. Or you can just use the search function and look for a certain topic, and it may come up that way.
Okay. Well, to get back to the new website, it's simple. It's very direct and easy to follow. There's nothing complicated about it. So I hope that will be effective, because what we want is for people who aren't sold on this yet to be coming upon that and find convincing arguments that they can access easily and might, you know, be drawn into it. And so it will take all of you listening and all of people who aren't listening yet, who will be listening to this later, to talk this up, to talk about it, and to try to drop links to it in as many places as possible to get people who aren't already on board here, you know, to take a look at this as something that will just show, I hope, it's intended to show that just Auschwitz, without getting involved in any other aspect of Holocaust, and just Auschwitz itself is untenable, and why the arguments by the revisionists are so good. And boy, there's some stuff that I found from later, from earlier, like from Staglick, that somebody mentioned. It was Fred mentioned him, and this Thies Christofferson, who I had heard of but never read his work, who I think is just wonderful, wonderful stuff. And so it might encourage people to go back and look at some of that material. Right? Well, we've still
I'm going to write up something about the alleged liberation of Auschwitz that was actually the opposite. And we may be able to post that soon, too.
Okay, yeah.
If I may say this, in my legal matter here in Australia, the important thing about Auschwitz or the Holocaust as such is that you can sort of question the 6 million now, and you can say, well, even Auschwitz didn't sort of have a function, but you must then do what Mark Weber and David Irving did, and that is to say limited gassings. This is where we're at legally. And it's a very interesting point.
Okay, Fred, we've got 60 seconds, less than that, so sum up quickly.
That's it.
Fred. Oh, okay.
That's it. It's done.
we're not going to hear the prompts or the music because there was a hang up, with Bradley. He lost his connection again. He's gone again. So, I want to thank Bradley for coming on. I want to thank you, Guillermar, and I want to thank you, Fred, for joining in. I hope I didn't talk over people too much.
No, it was
as
a pleasure.
I tend to do. And I think
you've done good.
Oh, thank you. Well, you guys are all you're friend of mine. You're nice to me. So, I appreciate you all so much. You know, I just I appreciate revisionism so much. And I'm glad that you're all there. All right, the music has started, guys, so we'll say good night. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.